Coming up next on 88.1 FM, a chance to get to know one of your neighbors better on Porch Talk. Like all of our programming, Porch Talk is made possible in part by Watts members, who show their appreciation of community radio by donating to WWER. For more information, go to wwer.org/membership.
This is Dave Tucker, your host and piano player for the Early Jazz Music Review, but today with a special Porch Talk interview with the esteemed Bob Taylor, a local resident of Colonial Beach and working musician who's had a long career in music and other things, highlighted in part by his time as the manager of the Hunter's Lodge in Fairfax in the 1960s, which featured his own Western swing band and many famous musicians out of Nashville, such as Dottie West and Willie Nelson. Later, he moved to Nashville, played in the band for Dottie West, and became a staff musician at the Grand Ole Opry. In this interview, you'll hear stories about names such as Dottie West, Loretta Lynn, Minnie Pearl, Johnny Cash, Patsy Cline, Boots Randolph, and several others. You'll hear about how he got to Nashville and what he's been doing since then. My co-host is Becky Hunt, who lived in Nashville and worked at Opryland. At the time of this interview, Bob is 88 years old with lots of stories to tell. This interview lasted over 2 hours, so we're presenting it in two parts. Here is part one of our interview with Bob Taylor. How you doing, Bob?
Very well, thank you.
Thanks for dropping by. So let's just get underway. Where were you born and raised?
I was born in Lynchburg, Virginia, and stayed there until I was second year of high school. And then I moved south of there to a little community called Alta Vista.
Alta Vista.
And south of Lynchburg. And I lived on a farm outside of town. Not a very large farm, but nonetheless a working farm.
So did you do some farm working?
Oh,
chickens,
yes.
And all that?
My grandfather and I got accused of being glued to him because of every step he made, I was right with him. But I dearly loved the man, and he had an awful lot of stories. And for when you're out in the country like that, and without radio, and we had a radio, which was operated by battery, because when we first moved into the place, we didn't have electricity in the house. So we operated with kerosene lamps, and anything like the radio had to have a battery. And in those days, the batteries were very, very expensive. They looked like they were put together with a lot of little batteries glued together into a packet. And they didn't last very long. And for folks who were had very limited income in the country, we couldn't afford to buy them too often.
Yeah.
So you had to look at your watch or the clock, and when your favorite program was to come on, that's when you got to turn the set on.
Yeah. How'd they charge those batteries?
Oh, they weren't chargeable. That was the thing.
Oh, jeez.
It was a disposable battery.
Battery pack?
For us, in those days, it was terribly expensive. We didn't get a battery very often.
What happened after that? You had a military career. How'd that come about?
That was after I had moved to Alexandria. When I got out of school in 1949, the next day after graduation, I had an aunt and uncle that lived in Alexandria, and they were there to pick me up, they said.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, well, what's this all about? And they said, in this little town, you'll have a time trying to make a living, so we want to take you to the big city. Not that Alexandria was all that large, but we were close to Washington, of course. Mm-hmm. Sure enough, they did. We left on Sunday, didn't go back.
Oh, yeah?
Other than for an occasional visit.
So you were kind of sent to live in Alexandria?
Yes.
And somehow that put you right into the military?
Well, I'll have to tell you this. I wasn't one of those gung-ho ones that volunteered. Not that there was anything wrong with that, but I didn't really want to go in the service. Uh-huh. I had just got started into music, and I was working, working at a furniture store, trying to think. Oh, I was there maybe 3 years, and Uncle Sam sent me a letter.
Ah, so you were drafted.
So I was drafted. That was a big ordeal. And the folks there at the furniture store, they were very kind to me. Bought me a lot of nice gifts before I left, and and some practical things as well. I still have a little case I look at periodically that looks like a little doctor's kit. And one of the guys bought that for me, and he says, you're going to need this when you go in service. He said, you'll see.
Yeah.
And not only that, he put in a couple of other nice things, like a great big nice shoe brush, like the guys on the corner that they would polish your shoes for you for a dime or whatever you could give them. So it was a time that I really wasn't looking forward to, but I have no regrets on it. After we got into it, I felt that it was my duty, and I hope I was a good soldier.
Well, we appreciate your service. Becky?
I was just going to ask you, were you able to play music when in the service at all?
Not in a formal band. I had the best guitar, I guess, one of the best that I've ever owned, was a Gibson that I had purchased a few months before I got drafted. The people where I worked when I was drafted, they chipped in and bought me a Gibson amplifier. They wanted me to have the amplification, but it was an ES-150 Gibson. After I got settled at a base in Carolina on one trip home, I took those items back to the base with me. We had a lot of sessions during the week. I was in service with quite a number of guys from Kentucky. Some of them had pretty good voices, and so they loved to sing. Fortunately, I could come up with the chords for most everything they wanted, and it passed the time for us.
Wow. So what happened after your service career?
When I would have leave time, the furniture store that I worked in Alexandria, they would let me come and work if I had sufficient leave time. I would do that, and when I got out of there, I did go back to the store, but I thought that I wanted to do something else, so I started going to Strayer College in Washington in the evenings to try and further my education a little. During that period of time, then I somehow came across, I think it was one of my neighbors that was working at IBM in Washington. I was able to get on with them, and I spent approximately 4 years with IBM. My last position was quite interesting. I'd been with them, I guess, approximately 3 years, and they opened a facility on Pennsylvania Avenue, right in sight of the Capitol, just a few blocks away. And that was a showroom for our first satellite that we were to send up. And we had the building, it had like an old store building. The door was in the center, and you had glass on either side. Well, the one side had the first pieces of IBM equipment. IBM was always, everything was gray in those days. Mr. Watson liked it that way, and the machinery was gray, and he wanted you wearing gray suits and so forth, but it was a wonderful company to work for. Then the other side of the building, that you could go in to the building and you were allowed to walk around, they had a display showing how the satellite would work, and we had something, a model of it, which wasn't much larger than a basketball.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, that place became quite popular, and we got to working around the clock when Russia beat us to the punch mm-hmm. with their Sputnik.
Yeah.
The big Sputnik.
Yeah. And
their satellite, of course, was much larger than ours. Mm-hmm. Not any more sophisticated than what we had, but just larger, and they could carry a larger payload and so forth. But they beat us into space by a number of months, as I recall. It was the time factor.
Yeah, wow.
And so it was an exciting time for us at the IBM facility.
Wow.
We worked around the clock because we were under contract with NASA
mm-hmm.
to compute the orbits
mm-hmm.
for anything that went to space, and any junk that was a byproduct of going up and so forth, all of that had to be accounted for. And
wow.
you had to know where it was and so forth, because also at some day it was going to come down and you wanted to know where it was going to come down.
Wow, I had no idea you were a space cadet like me. Something else we have in common.
Oh, how about that?
Okay, well, what happened after that? For now, I'm just kind of going through your timeline a little bit, and then we're going to get all into music. And
well, I went back to the furniture store after about 4 years with IBM. Well, I did take a few months between that and going to the furniture store, and I worked in sales mm-hmm. of IBM-related equipment. Like, everything was punch card in those days. I would sell cabinets and things uh-huh. like that.
Uh-huh.
And we would also sell to the federal government as well as to private companies. Of course, the government contracts were the ones you wanted, because when instead of ordering one, they would order 100,
uh-huh.
and, which made your commission factor a lot better.
Well,
but then at a point, the furniture store had lost their credit manager,
uh-huh.
and they gave me an opportunity to come back and be the credit manager as well as secretary treasurer for sort of a real estate type company they had.
Uh-huh.
And I occupied both of those positions.
So this was setting you up for some things you did later, the accounting background. And all
then that. From there, I got quite interested in guitar again.
Uh-huh.
Went to working around town a little bit. Some favorite hangouts in Old Town Alexandria that,
uh-huh.
fortunately, they weren't the knife and gun club type places. they were nice little beer parlors, and I got started then with a four-piece group. But I wasn't playing guitar very long with them.
Mm-hmm.
I went back to drums. I had taken drums in high school in mm-hmm. Lynchburg before I moved south to the country.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to get back involved with that, and I did. So it went on from there to where I wanted my own band. The guitar mm-hmm. player and myself were good buddies, and we would go out looking for places to play.
Mm-hmm.
And after visiting a couple of knife and gun clubs, and I told him, I said, no use to staying here.
Mm-hmm.
I remember one we went into that as soon as we walked in the door, they had a long flight of stairs up to the main room, showroom, and here come two fellows tumbling down the steps. And I told him right away, I said, we don't want to be here. We're interested in music, not fighting. And so
mm-hmm.
we went up the road, and the next place we got to was a place called Hunter's Lodge.
There we go.
And Hunter's Lodge, as soon as I walked in, I fell in love with that place.
Mm-hmm.
It was an old log building and quite sizable. At the time, we could probably see 200 and some in there, and had a huge dance floor.
Okay, so the first time you went to Hunter's Lodge, you were going there just seeking out a place to play.
Oh yes, right? just a place to play, and there was a bluegrass band there.
Uh-huh.
I remember one of the guys' names. It was Smitty Irvin, I believe. Several of the other fellows, I remember them, but I can't recall the names right now. And they had a four-piece bluegrass band that was quite popular in Washington at the time. But the thing of it was, for some reason, people, it wasn't the type of music they liked to dance to. Now, we in the country, in my times, and especially when I was still in high school, if we went to dances, it wasn't uncommon to have a bluegrass band. Well, they didn't really call it that then, they called it country. But it was similar to what a bluegrass band would be. It would be a mandolin, fiddle, and a couple of guitars. Anybody that could play anything was welcome to the stage in those days.
Okay, so what year was this when you first walked into Hunter's Lodge?
I would say it was very early 1962, very early part of 62. They had maybe, they didn't have much over a dozen people in there. And I approached one of the gentlemen. There were three or four people that were involved in it. He said, well, he was quite proud to have that named bluegrass band there, but they weren't drawing anyone. So before I left, he offered me one date. He said, you can come in on the next Friday, but he wanted the bluegrass band there on Saturday. He thought would be the big night. Well, we went through that, and it was still the same situation. Amazing as it was, we drew a pretty good crowd the first night we were there. We made it a point to go out and tell everybody that we knew. And in those days, the FBI had what was that typing pool. Was that before you had computers for everything to install all the information on, these girls had to sit there and type all day long. And it was a huge pool of those young ladies. My buddy, he was kind of a ladies' man, and he got to know some of them, and so he got them to coming in to Hunter's Lodge. And, well, by the third week we were there, we're drawing a pretty fair crowd. Well, I wouldn't say it's a crowd necessarily, but 50, 60 people, you know. And then the gentleman, I'll tell you, I shouldn't tell it on him, I guess, but he couldn't afford to pay me. And so that was about the third week that we were involved in playing and without being paid. So I found out who owned the building, and it was a Mrs. Faircloth in Fairfax, Virginia, and I went to see her. And her husband owned a large plumbing company there in Fairfax. I said, Miss Faircloth, I'd like to talk to you about the people that are renting you a building, and I'm very interested in it, and I'm playing music down there. I have been for about 3 weeks, and they haven't been able to pay me. She said, well, that's strange. They're not paying me either. I said, well, I'm sure you would like to get paid. So why don't, there's no big formal agreement on it at this point, why don't you rent it to me? So fortunately, I had the first month's rent in my pocket and shelled it out, and she was very happy to rent the property to me, and we went from there.
Wow. So just to back up, you had an established band when you went in there.
I had four pieces then. One of my favorite things, I don't know how come, but I was playing drums then. And probably because of the beat or whatever, I'm not sure, but it was Western Swing. I enjoyed Western Swing very much. I wanted to move the band in that direction. So I started adding musicians as they became available to me. And the next thing you know, I had five good musicians. One day I was listening to the radio. There was a radio station in Maryland that played country music all day. There was a young man on there that I heard, that I had heard on the radio on the Grand Ole Opry, and was Chubby Wise, fiddle player. Chubby played with Hank Snow on the Grand Ole Opry. Well, that's a funny story. I don't know if this was exactly when it came up or not, but one day You know, the musicians then, especially in the type of band that Hank Snow had, they only used one microphone. Mm-hmm. Hank would play and sing, and then they would want an instrumental or something, and whoever was singing would step back from the mic, and the instrumentalist would move up to the mic. And on one occasion, it seems that when it came his turn to get up and play fiddle, he longbowed that fiddle and knocked Hank's toupee off. So, needless to say, that didn't go over very well.
So what, he suddenly became available?
So he was suddenly available. And he came to Washington, and he was on the radio station there for an interview, and I'm sure hoping to find work. And when I heard that, I called the radio station immediately, and I said I would like to speak to him, and invited him to the club. Sure enough, he came. But for about a year, I used Chubby. That gave me six pieces.
Yeah.
And more the feel of the Western swing that I was looking for.
And the band really took off at that point. And so
really took off at that point.
So just to back up, you decided to operate Hunter's Lodge, a restaurant and bar and everything. You had your own band in there as the house band, right?
Yes. My own band was the house band. And wow. I was drumming. The first night that I opened there, I went to see the sheriff in Fairfax because I had witnessed one of those scenes of how guys like to get into it for whatever reason.
Yeah.
And I thought, now, I don't want any of this. And I asked him for a deputy. Well, you've got to pay him. And I said, I don't mind doing that. Uh-huh. And then the next thing was, well, now, he's got to wear a uniform. I said, nice, very nice. Yeah. I know he will be well recognized and he will be appreciated by me, especially. Uh-huh. So I had the same man. I was there a little over 4 years with me being there as owner and operator. And I had the same policeman that entire time. Uh-huh. And everybody got to know him real well. Uh-huh. And he was just a prince of a guy. Me setting up high on the bandstand, I could see all over the club, and if I witnessed anything that didn't look right to me, he would be right there next to the bandstand, and I'd just motion for him, tell him what I thought the problem might be, or something that he needed to check out, and he would go check it out. And we didn't have, to my knowledge, I never saw a fight inside of the club in 4 years.
Uh-huh. This was the first restaurant. You were serving food there too, right?
Well, it was a very light thing on food. Mm-hmm. I'll have to say that.
Okay.
There was food, but it was very light. And of course, the club was called, some people, when they have an affair and they want you to bring your own bottle, they got BYOB. Well, it was a BYOB club. We sold setups. Okay. That way, it made it much easier to deal with the state, ABC, and so forth. And we didn't have much trouble. That was a nice thing I liked about it. We only sold setups then, ice and soft drinks to the folks, and they brought their own bottle in.
I think that was common at the time, but I don't know anybody that does that anymore except for some
of the men's
clubs. I
don't know if the state allows it now or not, but they did in those days. Uh-huh. Anyway, it was very successful, and people seemed to like that.
Okay, Bob, let's continue with Hunter's Lodge. And my understanding is that you started to make some relationships with people with Nashville. Tell me the whole connection, somehow getting from Hunter's Lodge to Nashville.
Well, I started hiring artists out of Nashville within 2 to 3 months after I had opened under my name and running it. And I didn't have them every weekend because the band was getting better and better. After about a year, Chubby moved on. Uh-huh. And I think he went to Texas. Uh-huh. And in case, for those people who don't know about Chubby, he was the writer of Orange Blossom Special. That tune was quite popular and a marvelous fiddle tune, you know, that gets in all the contests that are played around the country. At the time the first few months that I had the club then. It was getting to be summertime, and I had the opportunity to play in a park in Manassas. Mm-hmm. They had a park there that was a town park of some nature, I guess. We played there on Sunday, and if I had an artist out of Nashville working with me on a Saturday night, mm-hmm. then they would stay over to Sunday and work the show in Manassas then. Mm-hmm. So that gave me an opportunity to become more acquainted with the artist. It also was a slight problem for me at first. I had a steel player in my band called Sonny Garish. Mm-hmm. To my knowledge, he and I are the only two living ones now of the original Stringduster band. He was a very talented young steel player. I could see he had a possibility of a great future. So first thing these people would do when they would hear him, they would say, oh, you should be in Nashville. Mm-hmm. And it went on and on like this for a number of months. But he and I had a chat one day, and I said, Sonny, whatever you do, I want you with me. But I said, I also have your best interest at heart. You're becoming quite well known, even though you're not in Nashville, you're becoming quite well known because of so many of the bands that would be playing in the Washington area. Their musicians would come out, and I would stay open. I'd let all of my patrons in the club go out at midnight on Saturday night, and then I would let these guys in the back door, and we would stay in sometimes till Sunday afternoon jamming. You call an old-fashioned jam session. So Sonny became quite well-known and exposed also to a lot of the better guitar players out of Nashville. So I told him that, I said, if you'll stay with me, I'll take care of you as far as trying to support you. Whereas I pay the other guys by the day, I would pay him a weekly salary. Mm-hmm. So he stayed with me then for approximately 4 years. And I had heard that Bill Anderson had lost his steel player. I knew Sonny could play his material, just write your QT. Mm-hmm. So when I hired Bill Anderson for a weekend to work, well, he wasn't there an hour before he approached Sonny to come to Nashville. So then I told him, I said, well, Sonny, it breaks my heart, but now's the time for you to go. Mm-hmm. I said, you won't be standing on the street corner and hoping that somebody will pick you up and you'll get a job there. You'll go there, you'll have uniform, you'll have a place to stay, and you'll be well fed. And so it's your time to go. So he did. He went. And
how'd it turn out for him?
It was marvelous. He is right now still playing, to my knowledge. Now, I don't really know Sonny's age other than he's somewhat younger than myself, but I think now that he is close to 80, I believe. Mm-hmm. He has done real well for himself. So after he retired from Bill Anderson retired his band, mm-hmm. Sonny then began to do a lot of session work. Mm-hmm. Studio work mm-hmm. in session. And he has done that since then. Has a real nice home in Hendersonville outside of... at one time, though, he lived right across the street from me when I went to Nashville.
Wow. Well, we're getting there. I'm going to bring up a name. Willie Nelson.
Willie Nelson. Well, I wouldn't say all of the people that came into the club knew Willie that well or of him that well, but the musicians did. Mm-hmm. I really wanted to bring Willie in, and he was one of the last artists that I brought in prior to me selling my interest in the club and going to Nashville myself. It was a nice weekend. Everyone, before he left there, everyone knew Willie, that was for sure.
Yeah.
And he brought another artist with him just to have somebody to ride in the car with him. But the guy was a good fiddle player, a good Western swing fiddle player. Mm-hmm. And as it turned out, we used him while Willie was on stage, the pointer he was on. It was quite an experience, really, because we felt we knew him before we got there. Mm-hmm. And we got along so well when he came. Very enjoyable weekend.
I've got a photo of you with Willie Nelson.
Willie and Wade Ray was the fiddle player.
We will post that online.
And I should mention also that when I get talking about fiddle, after Chubby left, about a year, I guess, I had worked with a young fiddle player in Washington before I organized this band. Mm-hmm. And I called on him, and his brother was a little older than he, also played in Washington at, it was the edge of Maryland, at a club there, could play steel some, but he was a great fiddle player as well. And I wanted twin fiddles because in the Western Swing Band, twin fiddles were, if you're a fan of Bob Wills or you mm-hmm. know that, he was a fiddle player himself, Bob Wills was. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I would want to mention them because they really rounded out my band so well mm-hmm. with having that. They were brothers, and they'd stand on stage and look at each other when they played, and they just seemed to know exactly where the other one was going at the time, and I just had a marvelous time with them.
So, you were becoming pretty well known for playing drums in your own band, and you were getting to know all these people. Tell me about the transition between Hunter's Lodge and Nashville.
Well, as I mentioned to you, about 2 or 3 months before I sold the business, mm-hmm. Sonny had gone with Bill Emerson. And whereas I got a replacement for him that was a crackerjack steel player, and we carried on very well, I really missed Sonny. And also I had hired a number of other artists from Nashville, mm-hmm. Dottie West being one of them. And I had her on a number of occasions, and the last occasion was about 2 to 3 months after Sonny had left Hunter's Lodge.
This is pretty early in her career, right?
Yes, it was early in her
career. She wasn't a big star yet, but she was a rising star.
She had a couple of songs out then. Mm-hmm. Here Comes My Baby Back Again was the lead for that, I think. Mm-hmm. But anyway, on this occasion, she says, "Bob, I'm starting my first band." She would go and play with house bands when she was hired, uh-huh. or either travel with another group out of Nashville that was on the Opry, and they'd have a band. Well, she would maybe be on that show.
Right.
So she wanted to do her own thing with her own band. So she said, "I'm starting my own band, and I want you to come to Nashville and be my drummer." So I sold out, and
big decision on your part.
Big decision
going,
to make.
Going for the
big decision.
Yeah,
but because I dearly loved the band and mm-hmm. And had a good time for 4 years there with it, and was very very successful with it. But I got to know a lot of all of the booking agents in Nashville and a lot of the artists. I just felt that this was an opportunity for me to further my career in the music industry. And
so the idea was to go to Nashville as just kind of a central location. I mean, she was a working musician.
But I was to go there as her drummer in her first band that she had. So I got to work then with her on the Opry immediately. That put me on the Grand Ole Opry the first weekend I was in there.
What year was that?
That was in 1966.
Okay.
I very much enjoyed it. Mm-hmm. It was quite an experience. Also, I had the freedom whenever she wasn't appearing on stage. Naturally, they only gave her at the time a couple of songs. Uh-huh. Normally, to do on someone's show, like one of the larger artists, or more well-known artist. So I could go around and ask other artists, could I play their spot? As a musician, we got paid by the spot.
Uh-huh.
So it was like being, almost like being a staff drummer at the time there. Mm-hmm. There were about three of us that did that. They had a young lady on stage that, a secretary there at the opera, mm-hmm. that would take down everyone's name as they went forward to play, musicians and all. Therefore, and that's the way we got paid. You got your check from the union once a week, and you would be paid by the numbers of spots that you had worked.
So were you able to play the Opry when she was not on the bill?
Oh, yes.
Okay. So you became a staff musician.
In essence, it's like a staff musician there as well.
Did they have a fixed drum throne like they do now?
They didn't in those days. We only were allowed to use a snare drum.
Yeah.
Then, and that's when we at the Ryman Auditorium. Mm-hmm. I did put a set of drums on the Ryman stage. Mm-hmm. I was fortunate enough to be sponsored by Ludwig Drum Company.
Yes, yeah, so we're going to talk about that, but go ahead.
Okay.
Well, At some point, I assume you became well known for being on the Opry on a regular basis, and you were approached by Ludwig, the main manufacturer of drums at the time, I think. And they offered you a spot as a Ludwig artist, right?
Yes.
And I've got a Billboard magazine ad in my possession that shows you as a Ludwig artist, and it's got other Ludwig artists, and you're sitting there right there, your picture, and you're right next to Ringo Starr.
That's right.
which I think is amazing. Well, just as a sidebar, tell me about being a Ludwig artist. What was that all about?
Well, basically, they wanted the fact that they could list me affiliated with the Grand Ole Opry. The way we culminated the deal was I was working some road shows with Dottie West, mm-hmm. and we were in that area where the factory was, not too far from it, and so I suggested we go by there and on our way to another gig and talk with the folks, and we did, and mm-hmm. We got to tour the factory, and they were quite pleased, of course, to have an artist from the like Dottie West at the time, yeah. to come in, and they had some pictures made there, little mm-hmm. photo session, and then showed us how everything was made, mm-hmm. and then had various, they had a lot of musicians that worked in the factory, and had some of those demonstrate the sound of a certain piece of equipment or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then they offered me my pick. They said, go down the line, pick out any set you want. So I chose a set. But the only thing I didn't want to give up, but I had to. I had a Ludwig set at the time, mm-hmm. and they wanted that set, I guess, to display somewhere. Oh, yeah. And they took my old set, but they gave me a very nice set of skins. And
wow.
Drums, I was very pleased with
drums and cymbals and hardware and all that stuff. Wow.
The whole works. That they told me, they said, now, for doing this, we want a picture of you on the Ryman Auditorium stage behind this set of drums, and something in the background to indicate that it's the Grand Ole Opry. Uh-huh. So I did that for them. The opera manager, I'm sorry to say, he wasn't terribly fond of me. And that's a little story, but that's a story for another day probably. But he allowed me to do that. And it was the first, to my knowledge, of unless they had leased the Opry stage for some other band to come yeah. in, like a pop band or something of that mm-hmm. nature, that they just didn't have a set of drums.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of pictures from the era where you just see somebody standing up playing a snare drum on a stand.
Yeah, that was the thing there. Then when they moved out to Opryland, USA, at the theme park there, then they put together a real staff band then.
Yeah.
You were the designated musician out there. Mm-hmm. Just at the point of them moving from the Ryman out there, I left and went into another area of my musical career.
Yeah.
Or somewhat related to it anyway.
Tell me more about Dottie West and your time with her.
She was a very fine lady, and she was married to Bill West, who was a good steel player. And he was the one that, to our knowledge, got credit for inventing the talking steel guitar. And he could do things with it that in playing the guitar, he would make it sound like the guitar was talking, but it would be his voice coming out coming in out front. Quite interesting, and of course it was new in those days. And so, and he played all of the shows with us on the road. He was our steel player in the band, and there were three of us, other musicians, mm-hmm. that joined him to make a four-piece band for Dottie. She was quite popular on the road. She was a nice-looking lady, and she had some good songs out. She's a Tennessee gal. Her mother had a restaurant in the little town south of Nashville, but she and Bill met in a college. They went to college together there in Nashville, and in Tennessee. That's when she got her career started.
Unfortunately, we have to cut it off right there and ask you to return next time to hear the second half of the interview with Bob Taylor. This has been Porch Talk on WWER Radio with Dave Tucker, Becky Hunt, and Bob Taylor.
The programming on 88.1 FM is made possible in part by WWER Watts members, who show their support of community radio by donating online at wwer.org/membership. If you like our programming, please consider contributing to wwer.org/membership.